It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa is not among the biggest states by size or population, but when it comes to historic preservation, we are certainly holding our own. The annual Preserve Iowa Summit takes place today through Saturday in Davenport. And this hour, I'll talk with people involved in a number of different kinds of historic preservation in Iowa, including an expert on mail order houses that came out of the Sears catalog and a historic wallpaper expert. My first guest is Paula Moore. She is state architectural historian in the State Historic Preservation Office, and she organizes the Preserve Iowa Summit every year. Hello, Paula.
Hello. Thank you for having me here today.
Well, and I would love for you to give us a little bit of an overview of the state of historic preservation in Iowa, because as I just mentioned, I mean, this is a very strong movement. Give us an idea of some of the things that are going on.
Well, we really do have a very robust historic preservation program here in Iowa, and I'm very proud of it. We have one of the largest local preservation programs with about 90 historic preservation commissions participating at the city and county level. We also have many property owners who are great stewards of their historic properties, as well as a really deep and well-informed consultant base, folks who work around the state helping people preserve their local resources.
One of the things that we hear quite a lot about is when something gets listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and that gives it a certain status and a certain amount of protection. What does it take to get something listed?
There is a nomination form that a property owner needs to fill out or hire a consultant to fill out. And that form is a compilation of historic research about that particular property and an argument why that property is significant and an explanation of its integrity. I like to say that we don't expect that the property looks the way it did when it was built in 1868, but there must be enough of that historic fabric left in the property to tell its story, to tell us why it's important.
And what does it mean for the property to get listed successfully?
First of all, it's honorific. So you go on a national list that's maintained by the National Park Service in Washington, D.C. But beyond that, it also makes the property eligible for certain financial incentives. So if the property owner is contemplating a significant rehabilitation project, then they can get historic tax credit.
You are one of the people that's involved in reviewing these nominations. Give me an idea of the kinds of places in Iowa that do get nominated.
Well, it really ranges from personal residences to downtown commercial buildings. I think one of the most important, the most interesting properties that I've reviewed in the past couple of years is a house. It's a little house, actually, in Council Bluffs, and it was the home of a couple. They were small people, and they were spokesmen for a candy company that operated out of Council Bluffs. And so with the money that they made from their endorsement of that candy company, they were able to build their own house, which was scaled to their size. So it's two-thirds scale.
I think that underscores something that's so interesting about this program and about historic preservation, is that the building doesn't necessarily, or whatever's being nominated, doesn't necessarily have to be grand or part of a really amazing part of history, but just significant. Do you think that people kind of have a misunderstanding about what makes something historic?
I think that's true. I mean, the preservation movement has been in place for decades, 50 years and beyond. But I think it's true that a lot of the early preservation work and the early National Register nominations focused on houses and other properties that had an association with the wealthy and the prominent in our communities. More recently, in the past couple decades, architectural historians and historians have become much more interested in properties that are associated with other people who also play important roles in our society, who make us who we are.
I think when we think about historic preservation, you know, you mentioned that so many of the houses and buildings that were nominated early on in the National Historic or National Register of Historic Places, a lot of those did have to do with the wealthy. I think that a lot of us still have those stereotypes in our mind when we think about historic preservation. In Iowa, what kinds of places tend to make it to the top of lists these days? I mean, you mentioned repurposing historic buildings.
Mm-hmm. Another property type that we're seeing a lot of in terms of the National Register program and also historic rehabilitation would be old warehouses. So buildings that are more industrial in character may not have nice finishes on the inside. In fact, may have bare brick walls and very little ornamental trim, but really great space and great volume inside. And so we have a number of projects around the state, Des Moines and Davenport, and other cities where these old warehouses are being converted into housing, or in some cases, multi-use space. So there may be a couple of floors that are being converted into offices, and then the rest will be residences. We occasionally see churches come through our programs, so churches that are still in operation and where people still worship there, but the congregation wants to do some rehabilitation work on the building.
How old does something have to be considered historic?
Well, generally speaking, a property needs to be at least 50 years old before it can be listed on the National Register. However, there are some exceptions. We have listed properties before they reach 50 years old. A good example of that would be here in Des Moines, Plymouth Place, which is a round apartment building at the corner of 42nd and Ingersoll, was listed on the National Register when it was about 48 years old. Because it had exceptional significance. So it had significance in terms of its architecture being a very unusual example of modernism.
Oh, interesting. Now, I can imagine a lot of things built in the late 60s or mid to late 60s and soon the 70s will be old enough to be considered historic. It's not necessarily a period of time that people celebrate when they think about architecture. How does that influence the conversation about preservation? There are some pretty ugly old buildings out there.
That's true. But, you know, it's a question of, does that building tell us something important? One of the sessions that we're presenting at the summit, the title of it is something to the effect of commercial modernism. What do you do when your building is younger than you are? So it will be a lighthearted but serious discussion about buildings from the 1850s, or rather the 1950s, 1960s, and 70s, why it's important to think about preserving those buildings too. And I think it's important for all of us to keep in mind that, you know, in the early 20th century, people thought Victorian buildings were drab and ugly and heavy, and so we lost a lot of important Victorian buildings in the early 20th century. And so we need to be very careful not to make the same mistake today about mid-century modern.
What kinds of properties do you feel are most at risk in Iowa today?
Well, I would have to say our agricultural buildings, in part because rural areas are not as populated as they once were, and so there just isn't the population base to support those buildings out in the country. But the other trend that's happening is that farm machinery is getting bigger than these old barns can accommodate, and so many of them no longer have a practical use. They don't serve the same function that they had. And so people have to make a very conscious decision whether they want to continue to maintain those buildings or not.
It's such an interesting question, because if a barn has outlived its usefulness on a working farm, of course, then, you know, the people who live there, the farmers, have every right to tear that down and build something that's more serviceable for their work. Why argue against that? Why keep an old barn if it's not useful?
I think it's fair to say that we won't be able to save all the barns, but it's a question of maybe establishing priorities and figuring out which barns are most important and then putting our resources towards those select properties. But, of course, it depends on how interested the owner is and whether it's a property that they value as well and are interested in preserving it. We do get a number of calls in our office from people who own family farms and have sentimental attachment to the agricultural buildings that are on that barn, on that farm rather, and are very interested in preserving those buildings. And so we try to steer them towards some of the programs that we have, National Register, historic tax credits and grants, as a way to support them in that endeavor.
As we travel around the state of Iowa, if you, as the state architectural historian, could tell everyone one thing to look for as they look around themselves, what would you have us look for?
Well, I would say take a very close look at your own community. The program that I work on, which is the local preservation program, as part of the application in order to come into that program, we ask that the Historic Preservation Commission literally drive up and down every street in their town. And I tell them that one of the reasons that we ask you to do that is because you will see things that you've never seen before in your community. Perhaps you've lived in that town all of your life, but if you're forced to look very closely at the individual buildings that make up your community, I'm certain that you'll see new things that had escaped your attention in the past. So I think that's what I would encourage Iowans to do, is just take a very close examination of what's around you.
Paula Moore, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Paula Moore is state architectural historian in the State Historic Preservation Office. She is organizer of the annual Preserve Iowa Summit, which runs through Saturday in Davenport. We'll talk more about historic preservation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about historic preservation in Iowa as the annual Preserve Iowa Summit gets underway in Davenport. The summit runs through Saturday. And coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with Rosemary Thornton. She is an expert on mail order houses. And Dwayne Tim, he's a historic wallpaper expert. But first, we're going to Davenport's Oakdale Cemetery. Now, by its very nature, a cemetery is a receptacle of history, but the names on the tombstones are just names if no one knows the stories behind them. My next guest, Dustin Oliver, set out to uncover the stories behind the names in Oakdale Cemetery, and he's found some truly remarkable ones. His research has helped get the cemetery listed on the National Register of Historic Places and the National Underground Railroad Network to Freedom. Hello, Dustin.
Hello, Charity.
How did this get started for you?
Well, I'm grew up in the South. Cemeteries are just kind of a part of the culture down there. You grew up going to decoration at my grandparents' family cemeteries, churchyards. So I've always had that kind of interest, stopped by side of the road cemeteries anytime I'd see one. And then started doing some work here at Oakdale with their Victorian Day events, living history walks with actors out playing people who are buried here.
Was there a particular person that really captured your imagination and made you want to dig into this history?
Well, the first character that I played in in 2005 in the first Victorian Day event was John McDowell Burroughs, who was one of the founders of the cemetery, who was a very interesting man. He went, got very, very rich and then died very, very poor, partly due to his helping Oakdale in its early days. He took personal loans. Because Antoine LeClaire, one of the founders of Davenport, would not loan to the cemetery company, but he'd loan money to one of his personal friends, John Burroughs. Part of that, then the banking failed in the late 1800s, so he died a poor man, but he used his life to make Oakdale what it is today.
So the cemetery actually was part of his financial downfall.
Yeah. It started out pretty good. 1856 was kind of a boom time for Iowa, and especially in Davenport. So it started out pretty good, but then in the later part of the 1800s, after the Civil War, money started getting tighter. Had to take loans out to help keep the cemetery operating. There wasn't much in that day because they weren't doing perpetual care yet, but they still had to, you know, maintain pathways and that sort of thing. So there was some financial hardships and, you know, loans that were taking place. Then he was a banker too, and his bank was one of the banks that failed in the crash there in the late 1800s. So none of it helped, but yeah.
So I know that you have researched a lot of different people who are buried in the cemetery, and I want to hear some of their stories in a moment. But as all of us walk through cemeteries, if that's something that you do, you see the graves, you see the names, you see the years, and sometimes the epitaphs make you wonder a little bit about the person. But what is it about a grave that makes you interested enough to really do the historical research?
Sometimes it could be just an interesting epitaph. I know we have one here. I can't remember the exact wording, but it was something about the unit that he served with the military. It was not an American unit. He would end up was actually a major during, I think, World War I with the Royal Army of Great Britain. So that was kind of interesting. How did this person end up here? Haven't got to do a lot of research on him yet, but that's one of those things that just kind of struck me. Another one was just a carving on a stone. There's a gentleman buried here named Vincent de Serra who has an elephant carrying an American flag on his tombstone. In today's climate, you think that's Republican, the GOP, but he actually was born in Sri Lanka and immigrated to the U.S. after the World's Fair in Chicago and was a tea importer. So it was the symbol of his native land carrying the symbol of his adopted home. I thought that was really cool and had a pretty neat story for him.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I want to talk about some of the things that you found in the cemetery that led to it being listed on the National Register of Historic Places and also the National Underground Railroad Network to Freedom. So let's talk about the Underground Railroad part of this first. You actually found the graves of 11 freedom seekers, people who escaped from slavery. How did you find those?
Well, a lot of that was actually Barry Jurgensen and his high school students from Nebraska did a lot of that work. As part of the cemetery here, we knew a lot of this already. Some of this, there were a lot of escaped slaves that were buried here just from kind of a verbal local legend kind of thing. And there were some obituaries that said some of these people had escaped from slavery. But really, it was Barry and his students that did the legwork on, you know, researching this and getting the documented proof. The interesting things that I found were several of the founders of Oakdale were actually staunch abolitionists and may have helped with the Underground Railroad. We don't have proof of that, but a lot of the men like Hiram Price, who was in Congress during Lincoln's presidency, was a founder of the Republican Party, which was very anti-slavery at that time. Men like that, probably that's probably the reason that some of these freedom seekers are buried at Oakdale is because those men were on the founding board of Oakdale.
The freedom seekers' graves that you found, I mean, obviously those who escaped from slavery left with absolutely nothing. What are these graves like?
There's a few of them that are in some of the what we call the single burial areas, what you might know as a potter's field or a pauper's grave kind of thing, with single stones. You just bought the grave site itself. But one of the families is actually buried right up on the main central hill of Oakdale in the shadow of the 40-foot obelisk marking the grave of John Forrest Dillon, the judge. Some of them are very, very modest. Some of them have, you know, more to them.
In getting the cemetery listed on the National Register of Historic Places, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, cemeteries are history. The people who are part of it are history. But what makes this cemetery historical enough to be on that register?
Well, one of the things that as you're filling out these nominations is in the rules, it says that cemeteries by themselves are not, as a class, eligible for the National Register. It has to be exceptionally significant. So it is a little bit extra legwork on that. It was we actually nominated under almost, I think, every category of significance for the National Register. Connection to national and local historic events. It was a burial place for the entire state during the Civil War, for all the training camps that were located in Davenport and Scott County. The men who founded the cemetery and people who are buried here did extraordinary things in their lives. We have congressmen, Supreme Court Justice of the state of Iowa. We have a Medal of Honor recipient. There's founders of the Republican Party in Iowa, people who founded the city of Davenport, plus the association with the Underground Railroad, and some of the architecture, the actual landscape architecture of the original 40-acre cemetery was platted out by a gentleman from Washington, D.C. named George F. De La Roche, who fought in the War of 1812 as a Navy captain, and also designed Oak Hill Cemetery in Georgetown in D.C. The mausoleums, all the buildings, just a lot of different things. It was a 106-page document that I prepared for that, so a lot of significance that I was able to find.
Just on the surface, tell me what Oakdale Cemetery is like. It sounds like a really beautiful place.
Yeah, it is full of a lot of trees, very hilly. You know, Oakdale is how they got the name, was the oak trees that were here. It was known in the early days of Davenport as the woods, this area. So it was actually originally platted out as farmland by John Burroughs when he bought the property back in the 1840s. Looking at today, I don't think anyone would think of this as farmland. It's very hilly, but now it's a beautiful place with oak trees, pine trees.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of the individuals that you have researched. There was a refugee royal, a count, who fled and made a house in Davenport. Can you tell me a little bit about him?
Count Nicholas Federer was a Hungarian noble who fled after the revolutions in the 1840s to America, settled here in Davenport because the Mississippi River, the banks, the bluffs overlooking the Mississippi River reminded him of his home along the Danube River back in Hungary. He came here, the legend says, with a sack of gold coins and was a very wealthy man, built a house, and was very instrumental in, you know, Davenport's building up in the late 1800s. People got loans from him. He bought property, bought a lot of land, made himself even richer than he had been. He was also a founder of the Davenport Cremation Society, and was one of the people that was cremated in the Davenport Crematorium, which is not located at Oakdale, but was the first crematorium built west of the Mississippi. So it's actually his ashes that are buried here at Oakdale under a fairly large gravestone that's in the shape of a cross, which I think is kind of interesting that it's such a large burial spot for just a, you know, small amount of ashes.
Now, you also researched the history of a University of Iowa professor, Phoebe Sudlow?
Yes, Phoebe Sudlow is another one of my favorites. I've had her as a character on one of our history walks before. She was the first female public school principal in the U.S. and the first public school superintendent in the U.S. She then went to be a professor at the University of Iowa without ever having a full college education herself. She went to a teacher training school as a young woman, and that was it. But when she was offered the superintendent's job, she was offered it at a, you know, lower rate of pay than her predecessor, who was, of course, a man. And I don't have the exact quote down, but one of my favorite things that I've ever read that someone actually said was, gentlemen, if you're lowering the pay because of my experience, that's fine. But if you are lowering the pay because I'm a woman, I will have nothing more to do with it. The committee convened. She got the same pay as her predecessor.
Wow. So do you still have a lot of individuals whose names you know, whose graves you visited, that you're hoping to find out more about?
Yep, there is. There's a gentleman, Albert Allen, who is buried here. Very, you know, modest stone because it's a fairly contemporary death. Died in the 1900s, but I've heard that he was actually with Teddy Roosevelt at San Juan Hill with the Rough Riders. Haven't been able to do much research on him yet. That was one that really intrigues me. Some of the men that are buried in the soldier's lot, some of these I know were at Battle of Fort Donelson. There's some of the freedom seekers that actually escaped slavery by joining the Union Army. But there's all these names that we don't know much about. So those I would, you know, love to find something out about them.
Well, you're making me want to go walk around my neighborhood cemeteries and find out more about the individuals who are buried there. Do you have advice for people if they want to get started with this kind of research?
Kind of half the battle is finding out where the information might be. I know the Davenport Public Library has some great resources online with the newspaper archives. So if your local library has something like that, that's a great resource. You know, search for a person's name and in relation to the town they lived in, or, you know, the town that they're buried in. You can find a lot of information. I've also found really cool info about Oakdale, Google Books. They actually have PDF copies of trade magazines from the stonemasons trades. Libraries, some cemeteries actually have lots of records. Oakdale, one of those, I was actually able to find a lot of information about the cemetery itself from board minutes from 1856 to present day that are actually handwritten from the 1850s, which was a little interesting when one of the founders, who was a physician, was elected as secretary. So that was fun handwriting to try to decipher.
Well, Dustin, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, no problem. It's a pleasure.
Dustin Oliver led the effort to get Oakdale Cemetery in Davenport listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Of course, he continues his research into the history of the people who are buried there. We're talking about historic preservation this hour. And when you hear the phrase manufactured home, the idea of preserving those homes for future generations is probably not the first thing that comes to mind. But Rosemary Thornton has dedicated her career to researching a specific kind of manufactured home. She's the author of The Houses That Sears Built, everything you ever wanted to know about Sears catalog homes. And she's speaking at the summit. She's with me now. Hello, Rosemary.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you so much for being here. And I think a lot of us have heard of Sears catalog homes. And I know that there were other companies who also sold manufactured homes during the same time. But paint the picture for us a little bit for people who don't know very much about them. When were these houses sold?
Well, they actually started selling them about 1908 to 1910, depending on which company you're talking about. And for the most part, after World War II, they had ceased, or I'm sorry, before the start of World War II. It's actually pretty unusual to find a kid home built prior to the Great War, World War I, because it really hadn't caught on until then. So when we go looking for Sears homes or kid homes, we look in neighborhoods that, one, are within 1 to 2 miles of railroad tracks, two, neighborhoods that are a little bit away from the downtown area because of the way the communities typically develop, and three, I have yet to not find a kit home on Elm Street. So we look for streets with residential names, tree names, and numbered names that are typically anywhere from 12 to 30. So those are some of the key. And the reason that we look within 1 to 2 miles of railroad track is because these houses came in 12,000 pieces and included a 75-page instruction book that told the homeowner how all the pieces and parts went together. So the logistics of transporting 12,000 pieces of house are a little daunting. So that's why they were often found within 1 to 2 miles of railroad tracks.
How popular was this? I mean, you said you've not failed to find one on Elm Street, which tells me there are a lot of Elm Streets. There are a lot of these houses, right?
Well, to be honest, I've done a lot of research. I started my work in Illinois and did some research in Missouri and around the Midwest. I am from Portsmouth, Virginia, and there is an Elm Street in Portsmouth. I mean, that's where I was. I'm a native of Portsmouth. And there is an Elm Street with two Sears homes on it. So that just cracks me up because you don't think of them being, you know, far out there by Virginia Beach area. You just don't think of it. So, but yeah, the trees, when you get into neighborhoods with tree names, presidential names, you're often in communities that were developed post-World War I, which is where you're going to find the majority of these kit homes.
What made them so popular? Because that does sound a little bit like a nightmare to me, ordering a house from a catalog and getting all of these pieces sent to me in the boxcars of a train and getting a 75-page booklet that told me how to put it together. That is the stuff of nightmares. What made them so popular?
Well, it was a couple things. One, and this is something, boy, if I were queen of the world, I would preach from the rooftops. These were truly quality building materials. It was first-growth lumber out of virgin forests, which just means that it came out of forests that we can no longer harvest today. It's where the trees grow very naturally, slowly. They're competing for nutrients and sunlight. So you have very, very dense wood, and that's why it breaks my heart every time I hear one of these houses is torn down. At the very least, this lumber should be salvaged because of the density and type of wood we will never, ever, ever see again in this country. One of the large lumber companies now brags they can have a house, a tree, a type of hybrid pine, ready for harvest in 25 years. And if you go to your local big box hardware store and feel the weight of a 2x4 and compare it to the weight of the lumber that's in these old kit homes, it's phenomenal. The main reason people bought kit homes was to save money. Typically, you'd save about 1/3 or more of the cost versus a traditional stick-built house. So that was a pretty big incentive to save 30 to 40% if you build the kit yourself. And also, it was a different generation. Today, we put together an entertainment center and break out in a sweat when it has 6 Allen screws that we need to use.
Right.
You know, so it was a very different mindset. Just 100 years ago, we're talking about our forefathers and foremothers as well were so much more competent.
I mean, Rosemary, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back, and we'll talk more about these remarkable homes in a moment. This hour, we're talking about historic preservation. With me right now, Rosemary Thornton. She is the author of the book, The Houses That Sears Built, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Sears Catalog Homes. She's speaking at the Preserve Iowa Summit in Davenport that goes through Saturday. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about historic preservation in Iowa this hour. The Preserve Iowa Summit is going on right now in Davenport. It started today, and it's running through Saturday. And in a couple of minutes, we'll talk about historic wallpaper. But right now, we're talking about historic manufactured homes, mail order homes. With me is Rosemary Thornton. She's the author of The Houses That Sears Built, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Sears Catalog Homes. And Rosemary, just before the break, you were telling me that these homes were made of incredible quality. They were built kind of like tanks, and the wood was of the highest quality. The people who ordered them were very resourceful and willing to jump in and put them together themselves, although they could hire a carpenter for that work, right?
They could, and Sears estimated the cost of hiring a carpenter would be about $450, which is mind-boggling by today's standards. But again, we're talking about money, you know, 1910 dollars. I don't even know what that translates out to. And I got to throw out a couple websites. One is mindsearshomes.org, and the other is gordonvantine.com, run by my friend Dale Wolicki, who's going to be speaking about the Gordon Van Tine homes, which were crafted here in Davenport.
Right, and the Gordon Van Tine homes were sold through the Montgomery Ward's catalog?
As well, yes. Montgomery Ward actually just turned over everything to Gordon Van Tine. So how you differentiate a Gordon Van Tine versus a Montgomery Ward home in these later years is very difficult. But that's something we'll touch on today, and Dale will talk a little bit more about tomorrow. But he is the expert on Gordon Van Tine. I'm just the Sears person.
So these houses, this is a remarkable story about American history and how we lived. But what's special about the houses? Why should we be interested in preserving these houses?
Well, a couple reasons. I could give you a dozen, but I know our time is short. One, it was a very different time in American architecture, American history. You know, the reason that we got away from the Victorian, and I'll talk a little bit more about this today, is because of the discovery of the germ theory. Suddenly we realized these massive old Victorians and the wooden bedsteads couldn't be cleansed properly. I mean, children were dying in great numbers. I remember reading a story about a family that lost 7 children to diphtheria in a period of, I think, 2 weeks. And it's just unimaginable to us today that they discover a germ, a bacterium even, is causing all this disease. So the bungalow became the new thing. And there's a bungalow, it was called the bungalow craze, and it just took the country by storm. And it was a way to make sure that you were in a smaller space that you could keep clean. So Sears' timing was just perfect, that he came out with these mail-order homes, and he sent them out by boxcar. Typically, one house filled one boxcar. It was very thoughtfully packed. And there's a graphic in one of the early catalogs that says, give the kiddies a chance. And today we don't really know what that means, but it was a reference to the fact that cities were so germ-laden. And I remember I interviewed a woman at the time, gosh, 20 years ago. She was 90 years old, and she said her father was a widower, and he moved her and her 4 siblings out of a tenement, really, in Philadelphia, out to the city to get away from all the filth and debris and the germs and the death. And, you know, the Spanish flu happened in 1918. That really changed the way we thought about cities in a big way. So it was the bungalow craze. It was Sears timing. It was a way to save a lot of money. Housing analysts estimated that after the Great War, there was a housing shortage of 1 to 2 million housing units. So really just all kind of came together. So the 1920s neighborhoods are going to be the ones with the most kid homes.
And how do you know it's a kid home? Because I'm sure there are people living in these homes that don't even know that they are kid homes.
Well, based on my research, and this has been probably going back 10 years now, so I can't say I've done a recent survey, but as of about 10 years ago, 75% of the people living in these homes didn't realize what they had until me or some of my cohorts knocked on the door and told them. So it's amazing how many people are actually living in these little pieces of American history. And you asked earlier what makes them interesting. It's Americana. It's merchandising. You know, now we have the Internet. Back then in the early 1900s, people thought you were absolutely just out of your mind crazy if you sent $2,000 into Sears Roebuck, Chicago, Illinois, in a little brown envelope and got a house by return. It was the Internet of the early 1900s. And look at Sears changed the way we shop 100 years ago. They homogenized everything. And Sears actually didn't produce much of anything, although they did have a mill in Carroll, Illinois, where these houses were produced, and millwork was produced at Norwood, Ohio.
Well, Rosemary, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're very welcome.
Rosemary Thornton is the author of The Houses That Sears Built, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Sears Catalog Homes. She's speaking at the Preserve Iowa Summit today, and the summit continues through Saturday. Of course, preservation sounds like you're just keeping something in the state that it is right now, but it involves a lot of restoration. It's important to get the details right down to the wallpaper. And Dwayne Tim of Davenport is an expert on historic wallpaper. He is with me now. Hello, Dwayne.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, you're welcome.
Now, wallpaper has been around for a very long time, but it didn't become affordable and therefore popular in the United States until the mid-1800s. What kind of wallpaper are we talking about when it did become popular?
Well, I guess you have to take a look at it. It was just pre-Civil War. The Industrial Revolution was happening, and that basically is what made wallpaper affordable to, if I dare say, the middle class and the merchant class and people in town. So as time has gone on, there's certain designs that have been more prevalent. Greek Revival had a lot of kind of stonework and arches, and then you get into Gothic. And, of course, you know, Gothic kind of self-explanatory, more of a almost looks like a church-type wallpaper. And, you know, you get back into the 1880s, 1890s, you end up with a lot of geometric patterns.
All right. And what kind of material was it made out of?
Just paper.
Just paper. You know, I think about some of this historic wallpaper, and I think about textures on the paper. Was that a common thing?
Well, yes. There's two different things that you can talk about on textures. First of all, there's flocking, which has been around for a long, long time. And it seems like the flocking runs in cycles. I mean, it's hot one decade and dead the next. You know what I mean? Another thing is that's been always popular is metallic inks. And I use a lot of metallic inks in my printing. And that can give kind of a texture if you feel, of course, I don't know how much you appreciate people coming to your house and feeling your wallpaper, but
as long as their hands are clean.
There you go.
So tell me about the work that you do, because when people are restoring a structure and they want to have historic wallpaper in it, it's not like you can just go out and buy rolls of historic wallpaper. What do you do?
Well, I tell you what. First of all, I find out what time period is their house. And, you know, it depends. And I work a lot with historic preservation societies who have house museums. And let's just simply say, for example, the state of Illinois with a Grant House up in Galena, Illinois. Okay, so they have set the date that when that house was given to Grant, which I think was just right after the Civil War, I think they gave it to him in 1866, 67, something like that. And I might be wrong on a date there. But so they normally take a 10-year span, 5 years forward, 5 years back. And you kind of go with that. When I talk to people, I always tell them that homes have evolved. For example, my partner and I live in an 1866 house here in Davenport. We have wallpaper from 1840 all the way up to 1960.
So when somebody wants historically accurate wallpaper, how do you recreate a pattern so that you can give them what they're looking for?
Well, I'm going to take an example that I did for the Vesterheim Museum up in Decorah, Iowa. They were gifted land which contained a house, and the museum liked the living room so well. And lo and behold, up an attic that survived the freezing and the hot cycles and the mice and leaky roof and God knows what all, was a roll of wallpaper and border and ceiling paper that they wanted me to recreate for the room that they was going to recreate into the museum. And upon research, that came from an 1895 Sears and Roebuck catalog.
All right, so you had one beautiful roll. It wasn't like you could just call Sears and get more. What
exactly.
did you do?
So I guess what I do is I go ahead and I copy this, and I use a silkscreen printing method to recreate paper. Probably originally, I'm going to say that it was probably a machine print pattern, but now it's down to being handmade by me.
How long does it take you to make enough wallpaper, if it's handmade by you, to cover a room?
Well, first of all, there's several different things. First of all, we can talk about how many colors are in the pattern. Going back to the Vesterheim Museum, there were five colors in the sidewall, five colors in the border, and only four colors in the ceiling. So that means that in each pattern, I have to cut as many screens as there are colors. So for the sidewall, there were five colors, so therefore I have five screens. Each screen prints a different color. So I'm running this paper across the table with a big square frame, the silk screen printing, and I'm all in registration. So I'm printing on the same piece of paper five times. I can print and lay up 70 yards probably in about a good hour.
Wow.
Keeps me from going to the gym at night. So there you go.
So there are probably places where I could order old-timey looking wallpaper. Why go through this process? What makes that special?
I'd have to say that if you're doing a house restoration and you're really exacting that you want something that's been out of that house recreated, we can do that. Other times people, you know, that's a costly process because now you're asking me to recreate this paper, all the screens, and do all the film cutting and stuff like that. It can be a rather costly procedure. And other people like to just keep maybe the good samples that they got from the wall and they order something else from me that's a stock pattern and they can save themselves money.
Where are some of the places in Iowa that we can see your work? I know you've done work at Terrace Hill, the governor's mansion, right?
Well, yes. If Governor Bramstedt invites you to stay overnight, you'll be staying in the official state guest bedroom, which is in the southwest corner of the mansion. And I believe that that room is not generally on tour. It's down a side hall. And due to fire regulations, they really don't show the room that often. But if you're looking to see my most famous contribution in the state of Iowa was, of course, the bridges of Madison County.
Okay, so we don't actually have to go anywhere to see this wallpaper. We can rent a DVD or stream the movie, The Bridges of Madison County, and see your wallpaper.
Exactly, and the first time I saw it, I looked for my wallpaper, and yeah, I had read the book, and yeah, I was in the theater there in Macogata, Iowa, watching the movie, and actually, I had to watch the movie again, just for the movie's sake, because the first time it was through was for the wallpaper.
Well, and I've heard that your wallpaper shows up in a scene that's fairly distracting, so you really have to focus on the wallpaper because this is a love scene between Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep.
Right? I always like to say that, and I say this tongue in cheek, that Meryl Streep and Clint Eastwood lay half naked on a bear rug and made out in front of my wallpaper in that movie, so there it is. Other places, I've done a lot of printing for the Living History Farms there in Urbandale, Iowa. Locally here in Davenport, you can go to the German-American Heritage Museum. They have two rooms up on the third floor from the original hotel there. I've done the wallpaper for them. There's just a lot of different examples, I guess, here and there, but that's probably the best ones in Iowa that I can think of.
So wallpaper sometimes gets a little bit of a black eye. People make fun of wallpaper. It was so popular in the 1960s and 1970s, and it, in some ways, can be joked about a lot today. What do you think about wallpaper today?
Well, now you're going to ask a guy who has a biased opinion. Is that fair?
Yep, that's fair. That's why I'm asking you.
Well, I think wallpaper is great. Actually, I mean, you know, and I've won over a number of people who say to me, oh, my gosh, there's no way in heck that I want wallpaper in my house. And I say, well, wait a minute. I got an idea for you. And they say, what's that? I say, why don't you buy a knockout border from me and go ahead and paint your walls and then put up this border? And you know what? You get tired of the room a few years down the road, you can repaint them walls a different color that would complement or even contrast with the border. Just don't paint the border over. Oh, wow, that's really – I never thought of that. So there you go. I think wallpaper, a lot of people think of it like – I mean, I have to probably give away my age here, that I was probably in my mid-teens in the 1960s, and, you know – living in a farm place up there by Lost Nation, Iowa, my mother couldn't wait to paint over all the wallpaper that my grandparents had put up in this house. And it's just not against my mother. It's, I mean, almost all of America did this, the
right.
whole thing. And
yep.
for a while there, this wallpaper, I think, just fell through the bottom. But anyhow, I think wallpaper is in a resurgence. You pick up any magazine like Home Beautiful, Elle Decor, things like that, you're seeing more and more patterns and papers that are being presented to
so
the
you
public.
So you think it's making a comeback. We have this comment from Lori. She says, my childhood home was an 1852 Victorian home in central Illinois. We think this is the date it was built because the wife was buried on the property. My parents remodeled the house but tried to keep with the original aspects. I remember spending summers peeling layers and layers of wallpaper, very thin, and every layer was signed by the person putting it up, sometimes up to five layers. So that gives us a little bit of a hint of what kind of history can be buried in the wallpaper. But tell me, in the 30 seconds that we have left, Dwayne, what do you find when you uncover old wallpaper? What makes that so special?
I think just the progression of history. I that's how I have to say it. Because here's a woman that has a house from 1850 up to present time, and you can see how things have evolved.
Well, Dwayne, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's been my privilege and pleasure. Thank you.
Dwayne Tim of Davenport, he's an expert on historic wallpaper, and he'll be speaking at the Preserve Iowa Summit, which is going on right now in Davenport. It's an annual summit on historic preservation in Iowa, and it runs through Saturday this year. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, and Emily Woodbury. We have production assistance today from Gray Lanta. Coming up next week on River to River and Talk of Iowa, it's Iowa Week. We're going to be talking about artistic Iowa all week long, many different aspects of the arts in Iowa. We're also going to be having our Great Iowa Potluck. That's coming up on Wednesday, the 21st. In Iowa City at 5:30 at the Terry Trueblood Recreation Area. You can find more information on our website. We would love to see you there. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.